Hello and welcome to DOS Game Club episode 111, which is a bit of a special episode because we're not actually talking about a game today. Instead, we will have an interview with John Passfield, the creator of the original Halloween Harry game and the 90s game that we played last episode. He also worked on Flight of the Amazon Queen, which was released as freeware a couple years ago and is now available freely on the ScumVM website. Nowadays, John Passfield is working on a new Halloween Harry game together with Peter Mullins. So we thought maybe we can ask these two guys whether they have time for an interview, and gladly they said yes. So here's Martin talking to John Passfield and Peter Mullins.
Hey.
John.
Hello.
Hello.
Good evening for you.
Yes, I can hear you, which is good.
Oh, yeah, I can hear you as well.
Excellent. Well, that's good.
Yeah, that's a very good start, a strong start.
I tried contacting John. I know what's going on. He hasn't replied.
Well, he did confirm by email, so I think he should be joining shortly. It's fun you wanted to join as well, Pete.
Yeah, look, how much I can contribute, I don't know. I'm not really a massive game player myself. My background's in 3D art and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly if you do start talking about the new Halloween Harry,
uh-huh.
I can certainly contribute to that, because obviously it's just been sort of John and I doing programming stuff, and I do all the art. And
right.
Yeah. So, but we've known each other. Well, John was best man at my wedding back in 19.
Wow.
And I was best man at his wedding about 8 years later. So, so we've known each other since the 80s. Yeah.
Oh, that long. Because John mentioned that you worked together on, what's the game? Flight of the Amazon Queen?
Yeah, well, I did some of the booklet art and the cover art.
Okay.
And bits and pieces. At that time, he was sort of working, all the game art was done by a guy called Steve Stamatiadis, who he ended up forming a company with, and all that sort of stuff. And then it became this company called Chrome.
Yeah.
How we kind of met, both have an interest in comics.
I can see that from the games for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. There used to be a thing back in the day where called apazines, where you would, you'd have a group of people, you'd do some art, then you'd photocopy 20 copies of that, and then you'd give it to someone, they'd compile it, and then the zine would come out every month.
Okay.
This is predates digital and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And what had happened was I joined and was contributing, and then this guy had shown up called John Passfield, and he had these funny little cartoons and quite dark. Twisted. I remember there was a group of us, and we'd always look forward to the zine coming out, and if John's art was in there, it's like, oh, fantastic. So I thought, I've got to meet this guy because I really love his art.
Yeah.
And so I just started from there, and then we ended up collaborating on comic strips and things like that for years.
Really? Yeah. That's interesting. I sort of knew John Passfield was into comics, and then I forgot about it again. Yeah. I completely focused on all the game stuff.
Of course, yeah. Well, that's, obviously,
That's interesting.
Yeah. So we've always sort of, our paths sort of went differently in the sense that he obviously went off and worked full-time in games and obviously had a company and everything.
Yeah.
I ended up with television graphics and doing, that's what I do right now is, because all the stuff I'm doing with John, of course, is we do this out of hours.
Oh.
So I work in television graphics, so doing 3D animation and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
And we sort of went that way. But every now and then our paths will keep crossing.
Yeah. And are you local? Are you like close to each other?
Oh yeah. He lives about 3 or 4 k, 5 k away. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
In Brisbane,
so you can meet up.
Yeah. We do. I mean, not as often as you'd think.
Now with the digital thing, it's also not as necessary.
No, well, we definitely contact. We use Messenger a lot for especially working on the games. Like I'm sure John will get into this. We're just currently working on a. We've got Harry that we're doing, but we're just working on a smaller game, an online game. It was based on the 2D thing we did, Robo Attack, and this is a 3D version of that. And once again, using Godot, because we've both become these Godot converts.
Right.
Or Godot.
Many, many indie game developers have, actually. Yeah. Unity used to be the big platform app to work on, but it's gone out of favor a little bit. And it seems Godot is the new favorite.
Well, I think when Unity started, I think they changed their pricing structure.
This That's the thing.
We had started doing preliminary stuff for the 3D Harry in Unity. And John, obviously, his day job, he works in Unity in his day job most of the time. But then he said, look, there's this thing, Godot, and this was a couple of years ago now, not a lot of 3D out there with it, but you can do 3D. I think it'd be kind of cool if we jumped in on it. And started from there. And to be honest, as I said, I only use Unity sparingly, so I didn't know it very well, but John does. Many a time he'll say, oh God, this is so much easier than Unity.
Yeah, I hear this a lot. Is people, you know, Unity is, I don't think they really care about indie game developers, like these small efforts. I think they want the big money. So I think they want the big program with the big money and all the that stuff.
Yeah.
And small creators, you know, they kind of fall by the wayside. They're not that interesting. So
definitely. Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. And of course, I was no stranger to open source because, how long ago now? 6-7 years ago. Because I've used 3D packages before 3D Studio Max days. Maya.
Yeah. Dawn of time.
Yeah, sort of thing. And but then I discovered Blender. How it came about is I was working on this short film and I needed smoke simulation and fire simulation, and the software package I was using, which is a thing called Lightwave, it didn't really do anything like that. And so I was looking around. I didn't want to pay thousands of dollars for, you know, whatever the latest version of a set.
Yeah.
Then I saw this Blender thing. So I sort of worked on that and I found it quite engaging. And so there just came a point where I've just completely and utterly now given over to it. And it's served purposes for everything. So I use it both in television, graphical design, obviously for games.
Interesting.
Worked really well. Like the pipeline from Blender to Godot, or Godot.
I don't know how to say it.
Same here. I say Godot because the play, right? Waiting for Godot. So
yeah.
But so
I think it's French. So Godot.
Godot. Yeah, I guess.
I don't know.
That would make sense then, wouldn't it? Look, I'm gonna force myself to start pronouncing it properly. But the pipelines worked really well. And honestly, we were expecting a lot of roadblocks, but so far there's been very few. And so we're getting our two major software packages we're using are both open source and free.
Excellent.
So, you know, I think there's something in that. Obviously, I still use things like the Adobe Suite for texturing and all that sort of thing. But I'm a little bit of I've become this convert to this.
You know? And people are definitely coming for Adobe as well. There's definitely free stuff being in the works for that as well. So,
And the thing is, what I like about it is that because I use quite a few plugins and things, especially with Blender, but it's so good because I don't mind because you know that the developers who are developing for it and for that those special little add-ons and things, they're just a single person, you know, they're just a single person outfit. They're charging really reasonable prices, so you kind of feel like, you know, I have no problem. You know, I feel quite good sort of paying money for that sort of thing when I need it. Mm. When you think about the big software package, people like Adobe or whatever else, you know, you sometimes just feel, when you have the subscriptions of a year, you think,
it's the same thing. I've always felt they only came up with the subscription thing because before that, it used to be a yearly update, right? They would have a yearly, and you would pay big money for the new version.
Yeah.
That would have at least one compelling feature.
Yeah,
I think they ran out of ideas for these features. I think they just went, we don't know. We don't know what to add to this. This like Photoshop has been essentially complete since 2005. So how do you make people pay for this yearly now? Subscription.
Exactly. And I think the other thing is that we've all become beta testers.
For sure.
So many times... I remember After Effects, because that's the compositing software that I mainly use with my television stuff. There was a time when it never crashed. Yeah. And whenever it did, the rare time, it would actually ask you, look, I'm going to crash now. You probably should save a new version of this.
Yeah.
That's long gone.
Save your project. Yeah. Come up with some kind of special box where you can enter what happened so they can look into it.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah,
forget about it. No, nobody looks into anything.
Yeah, that's right. So I think the subscription thing also, yeah, it means that we're all beta testers.
Yeah.
They release a thing. I'm sure they do some testing, but
sure.
And I work for a television network here, the ABC, and they have all their software on auto update. So you don't have a choice. It just keeps, because they want to keep everyone on the same around the country, want to keep everyone on the same versions. And so, so as a consequence, yeah, I mean, you who knows what you're getting in the new update? And then sometimes things break and then the release comes out, the patch comes out, you know.
Well, that's also the thing with these open source packages is I feel the updates make sense. Like they're actually adding things that you want to use.
Yep. I 100% agree.
Yeah. It's mad, isn't it? It's like the professional software is just a mess. And the free stuff is actually the good stuff now. It's, I don't get it.
Yeah. I do think there's something in that. Like Blender, it astounds me how far it's come in its short. Well, it's not a short history. It's been going for a while, but in the last 5 years, it is the quantum leaps it's made.
Right.
And I think Godot's going to be the same. I think it's going to be the same.
It's definitely picking up. I'm seeing so many people, like if I look at my Blue Sky timeline, I follow a bunch of indie games. So many of them have jumped onto this bandwagon. This is the new hot, definitely. Yeah. So. It's been 10 minutes. Yeah. Where's John at? What's keeping him?
How about this? I'll try calling him again.
Yeah.
I'll come back to you.
Hello, John.
Oh, Martin. I'm so sorry, Martin. I completely.
No worries. It's
embarrassing.
No, it's fine.
Don't worry, John. I've told them all the.
We've done the whole thing already. So it's done. No. Thank you.
I just completely because 8:30, and again, I said to Peter 7:30, not 8:30.
Well, I did not know where you were based.
Yeah,
so I did not know what time zone.
Yeah.
Apparently, Australia can't agree on what time zone it is in. So
we can't agree on how wide the train track should be.
Yeah, the change.
We can't agree on anything.
We change gauges.
Yeah.
And daylight saving comes into it, so it's all
Do you know much about Australia? Well, do you know much about?
We have some members in Australia, because we're this club, right? So we run like a book club. We pick a game every month, and people in the community play this. We've been doing this for 8 years, and actually, we've got quite a few members in Australia.
Oh, okay.
And it was someone in Australia who suggested maybe for Halloween, for October, we should do Halloween Harry. So that's what we did. So last month, we all looked into Halloween Harry, learned there is an 80s original we had no idea that you made on the Micro B, John.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's amazing to me. And we learned you're now working on this new one as well. So that's when I figured, oh, maybe I should shoot John a message and try to get him on, because this is all, you know, this doesn't happen a lot. Most of these old games are just old games and nobody looks at them. You know, Halloween Harry seems to be a sort of an active thing. So that's, it's amazing.
Well, I hope they do look at this new one. That'd be nice.
Well, that's honestly why we're here now, is just to get up to speed on what the history of Halloween Harry is and also what's happening with it now. So
yeah,
that's the plan.
Brilliant. We got to have it. It was a long time ago. It's 40 years and 30 years then today. So I can barely remember last week. So good luck.
we'll go through it bit by bit, and I'm sure it'll come to you.
We're pretty old, Martin. We've been around a while.
Yeah. Well, I'm not, you know, I'm not the youngest either anymore. So you know, it's fine. We'll get this. So let's start at the beginning. So we did Halloween Harry this month, the game also known as Alien Legacy.
A Carnage.
Alien Carnage. Yes, Alien Carnage. Absolutely. Which is the 1993 one published by Apogee, and I imagine the sort of the big one in the whole history. So we were very. It's very interesting to learn. This is not the first Halloween Harry game at all. You made a first one in 1985. I read.
That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. What's so? Can you tell us anything about this game? It's for the Micro-B. I don't even know what that is, to be honest.
That yeah. So the Micro-B is a. I've got one here. It's an old computer.
Okay.
From the 80s. It was an Australian computer. So yeah, back in the early days, everyone made a computer pretty much. So an Australian company called Applied Technology made this computer, which they sold into schools, and it was big here and also in Sweden. So they were the two places that it sold.
Right.
And yeah, as a kid, we had one. Our family got one, and so over Christmas breaks, I'd program on it and try things. And then first game I made was a game called Chilly Willy, which I'm showing you on the camera here. No one's
amazing on a cassette.
That's right. Yeah, and I made that over a Christmas break because I was in high school and I played a game called Pengo, which is an old arcade game by Sega, your Sega, and I loved it. But it was 20 cents a play in Australia. At the corner store. So I thought, I'll try and make my own version of that. So over the Christmas break, I sat down and programmed it on the Micro-B, which was great. So that was a lot of fun. So
that's brilliant.
Yeah, and I sent that off to the company in the back of the user manual of the computer in a place called Gosford. And then a month or so later, they wrote back, so this is great. We'd like to publish it. And I wrote back and said, go for it. I had no idea about if it made money or what, but yeah, then they sent me the cassette tape, and I was a published game developer.
What age were you?
I think I was 16 at the time, 15 or 16.
Amazing.
And then the following year was, Ghostbusters was coming out in 1985. And as Pete will attest this, in Australia, we would see the movies or hear about them coming out, and we'd probably get them a year later, if we're lucky. And then they'd do the circuits of the cities. And then in the country towns, I grew up in a country town, and Pete did well as well. They would show up, at the local drive-in, the cinema. So Ghostbusters was coming out, and I wanted to make a new game the following Christmas in 85. And so I thought I'll take the idea of like a Ghostbusters type concept, and I applied it to a lot of, again, getting magazines. Those ZX Spectrum or ZX81 games. And I saw screenshots of these games in the magazines. I thought, I imagined what they must have played like. I'd never played them, so I thought I'll make a game like that. And that's how Halloween came about, Halloween Harry.
Wow.
So it was an original IP, as you say.
Yes. Well, that's honestly, I mean, you did come up with the Halloween Harry name and character and everything. I don't think in that original 80s game he was quite as fully formed as we would, the jetpack wasn't there. No.
No, it was limited. I think it was like a 160 by 160 pixel screen or something. It was tiny. So yeah, it was a little tiny sprite, 8x8 characters. And it was basically, the idea was it was a ghost hunter with a garlic blaster. And yeah, you primitively moved around and shot
garlic ghosts. Blaster.
Yeah, garlic blaster.
That's what that is. Yeah, you
got to put that in.
And that was the idea. It was 13 screens. 13 is good. It's a Halloweeny number, 13. So it was 13 separate screens. And the game had sent that off to the company in Gosford, and they again said, we'll publish it. And it came out on like a disc compilation as well, on floppy disk. So it moved up in the world from cassette tape to floppy disk.
Wow.
So
keeping up with the times then. Yeah, that's...
Exactly.
Very good. So that's two games published by age 17, I'm guessing now.
Yeah, 17, I think it was. Yeah. That was, yeah.
Brilliant.
And I didn't think much of it. I didn't tell anyone. I my wife, who I'm married to now, was at the same school I went to, and I didn't tell any of my friends. I had two geeky friends, two nerdy friends. I told them that I was doing this, but no one else. It was a bit too embarrassing to talk about.
How is it embarrassing? It's amazing.
not
Australia in the 1980s.
Oh. What was Australia like? I mean, what was the game industry like? I can't imagine there was much of a game industry.
There was no, not much at all. There was nothing. We had, I think, The Hobbit. From Melbourne House.
That's right.
That was the big powerhouse, yeah.
That was actually, I think, one of the biggest games of the 80s.
It was huge.
Worldwide.
Yeah, exactly. It was amazing.
Yeah.
I met the person who founded the Melbourne House, so one of the founders of that early days, years later, and he was telling me that back then they paid £100 because I think they had a British office, a London office.
Yeah.
To the Tolkien estate. It was £100 for a 10-year license for the game.
What?
Wow. And I said, don't you wish you'd like paid like, you know, £400 and maybe get like a 20 or 30-year license?
What?
It was totally underappreciated. No one really understood what games were about or...
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, Lord of the Rings is not a... Well, I guess maybe at the time it was seen as quite a small niche sort of thing, maybe.
Yeah. And games weren't really, you know, they probably weren't... I think the film industry understood what they were and definitely the book industry. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, Pete and I were talking. Peter Mullins is your partner now in working on a new Halloween Harry game. But Pete has not, you know, just joined now. I think you've known each other for many years and worked together also for many years. So
decades.
Yeah.
Yeah, decades.
Very interesting. So, but I don't think in the 80s you were working together already, were you, Pete?
No, it was the late 80s. And that's when I told you about, we spoke earlier about the Apazine scene. And John first came to my attention because he was drawing these cartoons. This Apazine and are hilarious. And as I was saying to you, there'd be a group of us and we'd hold out that month because every month it'd come out every month. You'd supply a bunch of copies, it'd get compiled, and then it'd come back out to all the members. Mm-hmm. And we'd be hanging out hoping that John's cartoons would be in there because they were hilarious. And so I just remember one day I said, we've got to meet this guy. The originator of this stuff. John, it just sort of happened from there, didn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And just also the, like Pete's stuff and the other artists, they were like amazing comic book artists. Like Pete's done comic books as well. So I was the amateur guy who did the really scratchy kick and scrawlings of cartoons. Relying on my humor.
But that's interesting that you were both into this comic thing. I think it kind of shows in the games that you've made. I mean, isn't Halloween Harry a sort of a comic book character to begin with?
Yeah, I think, I'd say for both of us, we're definitely inspired by comics. That was a big, and movies, obviously. Yes. But yeah, so definitely, and I think what we share in common is we both think about things in terms of like storytelling and how can we make, you know, if we weren't doing this, and all Pete has done movies and things, but yeah, you know, I probably would be interested in doing film and stuff like that as well. But yeah. But games is where I've fallen into.
Yeah.
And once again, you know, we both grew up in country towns. So there wasn't a lot of access to popular culture. And John, I think John would say it's the same. More often than not, it was a secondhand bookstore that had old comics, you know. That's what was a big influence on me when I was growing up is looking at old comics and things and stuff like that and the storylines and things.
Mm-hmm.
John's a theme. You're like a big fan of 2000 AD and all that
stuff.
Yeah.
That was the second year. We were very lucky now in our country, even though country towns are sort of, you know, we got things last. We had, I think Australia had a really good book and news agency, you know, resellers of magazines were quite well funded in Australia, or well presented. We had everything. Our magazine shop in the small town had the latest comic books, and 2000 AD was a big one, the British magazine.
And there's John was saying films and things like that. They just, you know, there just wasn't a lot of stuff out there. Where I grew up, my town didn't even have a cinema. What we had was the drive-in. So, I think that's why comics featured is because we both were interested in this different sort of storytelling stuff. And the only way to access that at the time was,
mm-hmm.
you know, through these comics and things, yeah.
Well, I think it shows through most things that you've made. Also, you've worked together a little bit on Flight of the Amazon Queen in the mid-90s, for which Pete did the box art. You mentioned that, I think.
Yes.
But that also a very comic-inspired game, I would say. It has the whole comic section in the middle, right?
Mm.
With the jetpack also.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. The jetpack does show up a fair bit.
Yeah.
It's funny because I recently rewatched The Rocketeer and, you know, we're in the midst of doing Halloween Harry and I'm watching The Rocketeer going, gee, it'd be great to make a game with a rocket pack. I mean, we are making a game with a rocket pack.
Yeah, that's literally what you're doing.
Well, not originally, though. I think you talked about it. Initially, it wasn't.
Initially, we weren't going to do... Remember, we had the early discussions with Halloween Harry just because of all the difficulties involved with the vertical, going to on the vertical with a 3D game. And John said, no, we won't do the jetpack.
Yeah.
Anyway, as it turns out, you know, I think it was my son Charlie said, are you going to put the jetpack in this?
Surely.
And then we had a few other people sort of say, oh, it'd be good if you had the jetpack.
Yeah, I mean, isn't the jetpack sort of what makes Halloween Harry, Halloween Harry?
It is. In our defense, when we were talking about this, we were looking at, you know, I guess we could go back to doing, because we started out doing an Amazon Queen remake, Pete and I.
Really?
Yeah. And so we had that, we actually have that quite developed the first part of the game, and it's quite nice. It's a point and click adventure. But the problem was, point and click games is so art heavy and content heavy, and that I did the math and it was going to be at least, I said to Peter, probably think it's 5 years, but we're doing this. We've got other things we do as well. So we can't spend all the time in it. But I've got friends like, you know, The Drifter came out and that took a number of years. Amazing game.
Mm-hmm.
I think the 5 year estimation is probably, we're underestimating it. It was going to take a long time.
Right.
Because you've got, you know, 50 to 60 locations being built in 3D. Every single one is different. There's animations. It's a lot of work.
Mm.
So what we said or we talked about was, let's put that on hold. And we could do Halloween Harry, but let's do it more as a Vampire Survivors, very simple game. Keep it 2D, top down. Keep it simple. And then, as Pete mentioned, we kept finding things like we should probably have the jetpack, and people would ask questions. And
yeah,
it's evolved now back to being pretty much the original Halloween Harry, but way better.
Right.
Yeah.
And in 3D.
Yeah. And every step of the way, going back to the source, going back to the well. We go, oh, that's a cool idea.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see that, you know, and once again, let's see that in a three-dimensional way. So I think the big problem with Halloween Harry was that each time we go back to it, we go, oh, that's a pretty cool idea. It'd be good if we can have that. And so, yeah, so it's,
I think that's this tends to happen with all game designers. It's all, you know, the game never becomes smaller. It always becomes bigger.
No. And I'm painfully aware of that because, part of my, other job is working with teams and making games. Mm. And so I'm kind of at work the guy who will go, let's just cut that. Mm. We don't need that. No one knows about that. So I'm very aware that you've got to try and keep the scope down.
It's not a popular move.
No. And for this though, for Pete and I, this is really, we don't have a publisher. We're going to put on Steam. I mean, if a publisher comes to us and says, here's a bucket load of money, we'd entertain the idea. But we love the freedom, the fact that it's really... It's something we can work on. We make the decisions. There's no real deadline. We try and set ourselves deadlines. We want to, you know, get the game out, obviously, at some point. But it is a case of that if there's a great idea and it makes sense, we can do it if we want to do it.
Hmm. So is that in any way similar to how you started out? Because you also started out with a lot of freedom to do whatever you feel like, to make whatever you want to make. I mean, that high school period, obviously extremely free, but also very, you know, not a serious career. But it wouldn't be long before it did become a serious career. And the original Alien Carnage Halloween Harry game was very much made in a sort of professional way. It had ambitions, didn't it?
Yeah, it was interesting because that was actually very similar to what we've done again, repeated 30 plus years later, was we started making, actually, in this case, it was two games. Jumping from high school, when the original Halloween Harry is made, I did a computer science degree in Brisbane, where we are now,
mm-hmm.
and graduated from the degree program and started working at a telecommunications company. And at this point, we're doing the Appazine, so I knew Pete and other people.
The comic thing, yeah.
And Pete knew the horrors I was going through at work with my job, which was just complete, it was an awful job of programming at this company that was just, it was soul destroying. And I remember I had the, Matt Groening had comic books called Work as Hell. And I remember getting a Work in Hell comic book, and in the Work as Hell, Matt Groening, who does Simpsons, drew a great cartoon strip where the employee guy was making little, toys out of, erasers and push pins. And I looked at that and in my desk, I had done the same thing. I was living that life. Mm. I was,
yeah.
So, and I would tell Pete how terrible it was. And Pete was also working video production. And I think you're having a similar issue as well, Pete.
Yeah, long hours in video production. And I was sort of hating it. And anyway, so we'd come home and share war stories about this. But then John would want to quit his job.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd keep saying, oh, John, don't do that. Just, you know, make sure you've got something to jump to. I mean, the game thing was happening, but wasn't quite there yet. I think you're still looking for a publisher at that point, weren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
So you had, yeah. I mean, you had this corporate job, but you were thinking of making games and were trying to.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
you felt you had to do that, or?
No, I actually hated computers because of the job. I detested them. And it was through, again, another friend of ours, John Barry, I went to university with him. He dropped out of university and he started working at the comic book shop. And so that was the nexus, the point where I'd met Pete and Sam and others and other friends of ours. And so it was through my friend from university who got into comics, and I was making comics and part of the upper zine. Also another person called Steve, and Steve wanted to do a computer game because he had an Amiga computer and was doing graphics.
Right.
But he knew I'd made a games when I was in high school. He suggested making a video game, but I was just so in hate with computers. I detested them.
Mm.
Saw the Amiga and it was like, it rekindled that spark again. I thought, okay, this is fun. And then I bought an Amiga and then we started tinkering around. And ironically, we started making two games, which is dumb. Remaking Halloween Harry, which is the game I made as a kid. And then having played Ron Gilbert's Monkey Island, was like, this is amazing. We should make a point-and-click adventure game. So we started making a point-and-click.
Right. Well, actually, I was wondering about this because it's such a weird lineup. I think the company you formed is called Interactive Binary Illusions, right?
That's correct, yes.
If you look them up on Mobi Games, there's two games by them. One is Halloween Harry, the platformer, the very shooty one. And then there's Flight of the Amazon Queen, a point-and-click adventure game. Very two different genres.
Well, it goes back to what you said about we were making what we wanted to make.
Mm.
So that's really what happened. So we wanted to make an adventure game like Ron Gilbert's and Monkey Island, and so we started doing that. At this point, it was burning off more than we could chew. And ironically, we met some other people who took over the programming of Halloween Harry, which was great.
Right.
And that one was made first. We got that out the door, 93.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You'd quit your job by then, hadn't you?
Yes, I quit my job, thank God.
Because I'd come home one week, because like just after saying to John, don't quit your job, you don't. And I'd had enough. So I quit my job and decided to do comic books full time. And John said,
really?
What?
I felt betrayed.
Next week.
So you inspire John to also give up the professional real, yeah.
That's what happened.
Yeah. That's amazing.
But the weird thing was Pete and I were also doing a comic strip at the same time. Yeah. So we were published in an actual national magazine. He did all the work and I just wrote some ideas really. But that paid our rent pretty much.
That's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
So is this comic stuff still around? Can you find this anywhere online?
Thankfully, no.
Okay.
No, the reason why I said that is, I don't know, Peter, it was in a men's magazine.
Oh.
Yeah, there's these, and so it was a little character, Dingo Boy, he was called. And it was this sort of...
Dingo Boy?
Yeah.
I'm going to write that down.
Backtrack. John was also a big fan of Viz Comics, the English comics called Viz.
Okay.
Which is still around, isn't it, John?
It is. I've got...
Anyway.
I bought just this week. Yeah.
There you go. So we wanted to do a strip for Viz. And they were doing an Australian version of it. And we came up with this idea. So it's absurd sort of British humor, yeah. Anyway, so we come up with this idea. But unfortunately, I don't think they ended up going ahead with an Australian version or something.
No.
But anyway.
Well, maybe one or two issues, yeah.
Yeah, but John had discovered that these men's magazines in Australia had comic book sections comic strips at the end, like funny, jokey, blokey.
Yeah.
And so we managed to get a gig with that, and they paid really well.
Wow.
Mm. So
that's the dream, isn't it?
Well, yeah, that sort of helped sustain, well, John being able to do the games,
yeah.
Steve, and then me also pursuing other comic stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and it was the 90s, and back then these magazines, you could buy them at the local truck stop or they were quite prevalent. But if you roll back the clock, if you bought them out now, you go, oh my God, this is politically incorrect. But back then it was all perfectly, it was funny, everyone was into that.
Yeah, well, yeah, sure. I mean, that's, a lot of 90s humor.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. So I have two questions actually about this period. I mean, the first question is, if you look into Halloween Harry, it says it was developed by Interactive Binary Illusions, but it also says it's made by Sub-Zero Software.
Yes.
What's this? There's nothing to be found about these people.
That's correct.
They made one game, which is Halloween Harry. So what?
Yeah. So what it was, so Steve and I were making the Halloween Harry remake, and we're talking with different people about how to get this published. And I remember talking to a company, I think they're called... they were based in Sydney, and I rang them up and said, look, we're making a game. And they said, oh, yeah, the games don't sell. You might maybe make a few thousand dollars out of it. And I thought, well, that's not right, because I actually made, I think all up from the original cassette version, I'd made probably $1,000 or so.
Right.
And that was really low budget. And I knew there were games in America and everywhere else, so the guy was completely wrong.
Yeah.
But we found a local person, an animator called Lindsay Whip, and he had made a game called Baron Baldrick. And then through him, we'd met Menacom, a Brisbane-based publisher who published the box version of Halloween Harry eventually. But they said, you should talk to these two kids. I mean, we were only young as well in our early 20s. And that was Tony Ball and Robert Crane. And so they were two separate guys. And they saw Halloween Harry and said, oh, can we program that? And we went, well, yeah, because we're trying to do two games. And
right.
So Tony did the graphics engine for both games. And Robert did the programming for and some design work on Halloween Harry Remake. And so they needed a name themselves. It was very loosey-goosey. Like, we were called Gee Whiz. I think we registered our business name, but they didn't have anything and they weren't employees, so they called themselves Sub-Zero.
Right.
So that's what Sub-Zero was. That's how that came about.
So this, when you say we got some people to program Halloween Harry for us, this is what you mean, is the Sub-Zero people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So and again, we're all living, you know, at home or, mm-hmm. you know, wherever. So you go around to Tony's places and his parents. And yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, another friend of ours, which Pete knows really well, Darren Baker. Darren was the audio programmer on Halloween Harry, and you know, his little brother, who was in high school, he was 17 years old. He did the music along with Steve's little brother, who was the same age. So these two high school kids did the music for the game.
Oh, that's amazing.
Quite funny.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. It was very, very, very small.
But then, I mean, it started out small and all very, you know, a bunch of kids making game. But then actually it got published through Apogee, through Scott Miller.
Yes.
Which is huge.
Yes.
So this is an enormous step to take from being a bunch of kids doing, like you say, loosey-goosey making a game.
Mm.
How on earth do you get on Scott Miller's radar?
Well, that was through Menacom, the small publisher in Brisbane. So they were the exclusive distributors of all the Apogee games and shareware in Australia. And so what was great was we're being published locally through Menacom, and then they showed off to Apogee, and that's how we came on the radar. And it was really nice because I tweeted about the anniversary just recently, and George, so I still speak to George to this day. George was Scott's partner mm-hmm. in Apogee.
George Broussard, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he did Duke Nukem. He said it was interesting because they had a bunch of games internally they were doing and publishing, and they really dropped that down. But they were kind enough to take ours on and publish ours worldwide, which is great.
Yeah.
And that got us that exposure.
That must have been huge.
It was. And FormGen then picked it up and did the a box copy into Walmart and other places. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was very exciting.
I heard Scott Miller even has an Australian connection.
He lived out here for a while, yeah.
But you never met him in Australia?
No, never did, no. And in fact, I've never met George in person. I chat to George probably every few weeks. We chat on, you know, text message or whatever,
yeah.
And compare notes about games. And yeah, he's in Texas.
Yeah, that's a long way.
It is.
And he was making Duke Nukem, which is an interesting thing to mention. I mean, people have brought up when we were playing, Halloween Harry, Alien Carnage. It's very similar to Duke Nukem 2.
Mm-hmm.
Also a shooty platformer, also released in the same year, I believe, you know, big muscly hero who saves everyone. So, another Apogee game, obviously.
Yeah.
So were you talking to these people? Was there any communication back and forth, or were you at opposite ends of the globe making the same game?
I think, yeah,
that's what it seems like.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I don't remember. We were pulling references from probably more Sega games and that sort of stuff. Like we had the little, we thought it was innovative, you know, little bar at the bottom with a little cameo in the text,
mm-hmm.
which I'm not sure. I mean, I think we were drawing the same inspiration. So it was just kind of coincidental. Also, bearing in mind, this is influenced from the 80s. So Duke Nukem, yeah, Snake Plissken from... what's the movie, Pete? You know the one? Escape from New York. Yeah. Snake Plissken. There's a lot of characters that...
Bit of Arnie.
Yeah, the Rambo influences there.
Yeah, so a lot of that stuff was influencing in those games. Again, of course, Ghostbusters. So I think you'll find that a lot of those games probably, not that we're copying each other, but we just were drawing from the same well.
Yeah.
And that's where it came out of, that sort of inspiration.
Yeah, that makes sense. It was quite a hot title, I believe. I mean, people were into Halloween Harry when it came out, for sure.
Well, Pete's got some stories because, you know, we weren't sure. Well, people remember. I have this feeling that there's a bit of nostalgia happening and people will remember it. But Pete's had some, and I have, but Pete's story. You've had a few stories, Pete.
Oh, God, yeah. The number of times we've bumped into generally males of a certain age, and we mentioned the Halloween Harry thing, and their eyes light up.
Yeah.
And it's bizarre. And it's happened. It's not like once or twice. It's
no.
Quite a lot.
Yeah.
That's why I think that's why we thought, well, there's a little something in this. We did, what's it called, John, the game? Oh,
Queensland Games Festival.
Queensland Games Festival. Not this year, but last year. And very early on when we talked about doing this new Harry, I kind of said, I don't really want to do anything with blood. You know, I don't want to go down that road. You know, I want to keep it pretty. I mean, yeah, we got zombies in it, but, you know, yeah. They have green, you know. Yeah. Anyway, and kind of glad we did because we noticed something at this festival. People who are coming up to play our very, very basic demo. It's God, it's changed so much since then. And it was dads with their kids. And they'd come up to say, oh, I played this game when I was a kid, you know.
And now they want to play it with their kids.
Exactly. Yeah, and it was a thing. It wasn't just once. It happened quite a bit. And we thought, well, we had no idea.
Yeah.
But John said, I don't think I was going to remember this game. I said, well, it's weird. It seems to be a thing.
Yeah. Was a big title for sure.
Yeah, I was thinking of the incident with the you were doing some sketches at the outside the library.
Oh yeah, I was doing some design work and I was at outside a library here and I think I was waiting for I had my car at the mechanic or something, so I had a bit of time, so I brought sketch. I knew I was going to have to wait for it, so I was getting a coffee and anyway, and I just noticed someone kept looking at me once again, a man of a certain age, and he had his kids with him too, and he came over and said, oh, can I just ask what you think? I said, no, I explained it. He said, Halloween Harry. And yeah, once again, he is a massive fan of it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it just, out of the blue.
Crazy.
You said you didn't notice this at the time, but surely you must have noticed like your game is in a box on the shelves in the shops.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, because I'm very aware now at this age to not take anything for granted. Mm. But back then it was pretty special. We even had some TV spots. I'll send you the channel. I'll send you some of the
TV spots.
Yeah. There was a local student. They did an interview with myself. Well, actually, no, I stood back. So I was watching them again. It was Robert or Steve would do the talking. And I was like in the image or in the background tapping on keyboards. I was very shy. They did two interviews with us. And there was also a games review. I'll send you the link so you can.
Okay. Yeah, love to see this.
And then seeing a box copy was very exciting. Although I have a funny story because I remember telling this to Pete. We went into the Menacom publisher and the gentleman who publishes is very, very nice. It's a husband and wife team. And they had the boxes there. And I went, oh, wow. I said, are these ours? And the wife, she was very, very sharp. She turned and said, no, there are more important people than you. They'll get theirs first. I went, what?
Literally made the game.
I know. No. We didn't publish any more games with them. That was their first and only game that we published with them. But I was like, whoa, that's a bit rude. Is it?
So yes. Amazing.
But John, things you've told me and you might go into it, the publishers and things, but that was kind of the vibe of the time.
Yeah.
Well, the publishers were terrible.
It was
just the way they treated artists. It was terrible.
It was so disposable. I mean, the whole thing with Amazon Queen and the experience with Electronic Arts was just, I've talked about it before, but we had Electronic Arts Australia were very interested in Amazon Queen and we went down to show it to them and they liked it. And so again, we were doing this for gratis. We weren't being paid by them. So we were putting this effort in and we thought, they said, oh, the head of the European division of Electronic Arts is coming to Australia. Come down and set it up and show it to him. And so we set up both games, Amazon Queen and Halloween Harry, and we had them playable. And he came in. I said, hi, he said, oh, don't tell me your name. I won't remember it. I said, oh, okay.
Oh, my God.
And then he went to Halloween Harry was on the PC. And we had Amazon Queen on the Amiga because at that stage, Amazon Queen was being programmed in AMOS. Hmm. And he just said, you've got the wrong platforms. You know, this one should be on the PC and that one should be on the Amiga. And he just tore shreds about how the quality has to be 100 times better than LucasArts. And he just went on and on and on. It was just so rude. Then he walked out of the room and I went, what's happening? And the Australian people who'd organized the meeting went, oh, I guess we're not publishing it.
Wow.
I was like, I don't know what. And we packed our gear up, and as I walked out, I said, thanks for nothing.
No. Wow, that's...
Yeah, it drove us to... I got back, and as I remember, I had the fax machine, and I just faxed every single UK publisher from from the UK magazines, like Amiga Format and all the different ones, and faxed them all and sent them copies of Amazon Queen and stuff over. And we end up meeting Renegade, who were the delightful, most amazing publishers. They were a partner with Bitmap Brothers, and we met the Bitmap Brothers, and they were the complete opposite. They were so wonderful. They flew us out and they were incredible. And likewise with Apogee, they were the other end of the spectrum. The same end. They were very nice and helpful and lovely. So
yeah,
we had two good experiences, but we had a few rough ones initially.
In a sea of terrible ones.
Yes.
Now, you mentioned GWiz. I mean, first the company was called Interactive Binary Illusions, then it was renamed to GWiz because Steve?
No,
is it because of Steve? No.
Pete's actually the reason for the name. But what happened was we had, I used to answer the phone and go, hello, it's IBI, because I had this saying Interactive Binary Illusions. And then go, oh, this is IBM. I go, no, not IBM, it's IBI. And it sounds like a urinary tract infection. Yes. Anyway, Pete, I was telling Pete about, just the name was terrible. And Pete said, well, do you remember what you said, Pete? I know what you said, but I'd love to hear yours taken.
I can't remember. What did I say?
You said you're such a G-Wiz sort of company. You guys are.
Some bit of business you'd done was really impressive. And I went, wow, you're such a G-Wiz, the way you just, it feels like they magic these things up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
I was like, that's it, G-Wiz Entertainment. And so that's, we changed the name. And I love that name. It's such a great name.
Much better name. Yeah, the much better name. And actually, this is the company that developed the Zombie Wars,
yes,
the sequel to Halloween Harry.
Yes.
Which is the third game, I suppose, in the series, in a way.
Yes, it is. And that was, we're very proud, because we took a lot of stuff, like Halloween Harry, much as it's a wonderful game, it's got some bad design decisions, because we didn't know what we were making up as we went along. But you'd walk into a space where you couldn't see your character and you'd be beaten by a monster you couldn't see, and the jetpack would run out of fuel, and you couldn't go anywhere. It was
no jumping.
No,
that's the thing when you're out of fuel,
that's it.
And also the flamethrower eats the fuel.
Yes.
So
so we tried to rectify a lot of that in Zombie Wars, and then we had the great idea of, let's publish this online and do it as an online sale.
That's early 96.
We were too early. We were probably 10 years ahead of the curve. We really should have going back to Apogee and said, hey, publish this. But we thought, let's get on this whole, online selling.
Indeed.
Yeah, we're indeed.
But in 96, there was no Steam.
No.
There was no itch.io.
No.
There was nothing.
We had a website. We tried to sell it. We had, there was a company that had, you could do the credit card details. RegNow. We were using RegNow.
Okay.
Yeah. RegNow was just
sold. 96 is... I think that's before Google.
I know. We were just stupid. We're just too stupid. But we do that. I mean, like Pete and I, later on, we've done Apple Watch games. We tend to I have a habit of finding a new technology that's unproven. And I go, let's make a game in this space. Let's do a Facebook game, or let's do a...
Told you, didn't I? Like, we had that conversation, didn't we?
Yes.
Or the interview, I said, how about John? He likes to try these new...
Well, I've wrapped Pete in... So I mentioned Christmas projects, like the original Halloween Harry's Christmas project. So right now, Pete and I are doing a little Christmas project, something. So we're doing a little thing for the web. Because I said, Pete, I really believe web is the future. Let's try that. So we've got a little something. But I do tend to, it sometimes it pays off.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, if you're early, it can really work out.
Yeah.
If it blows up and if it turns out to be the right path. And also, I'm not sure if it is the right path or that it just becomes the right path because everyone chose it. So, So if you're one of those people who are on that path early, could work out.
It could do, yeah. We weren't with Zombie Wars. So Zombie Wars came and went, sadly.
Right.
Yeah. And one thing we did with Halloween Harrow was we made it a freeware game.
Yeah, I know.
Which was really good. Yeah, and I think we haven't done that with Zombie Wars. It's a bit more complicated because it's for Windows and...
It's harder to run on a modern system. So yeah. You could technically do that then? I mean, you have the rights to this to do this or...
Yes, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, one day.
Yeah, perhaps if someone makes a Windows box software to...
Yeah, tell them to get in touch with us. We'll be interested in getting Zombie Wars out there and do a tie-in with the launch of the new one. Yeah.
Well, I think it's possible to run... Because Zombie Wars runs on Windows 95, but also on Windows 3.1, the old one.
Yes, I believe
so. And I think you can install that inside DOSBox.
Okay.
I think technically you could make it work.
Yeah.
But might be a lot of fiddling. I don't know.
Yeah. Didn't we joke about the levels with the new one that we want to have the game in there? Then we sort of spoke about that, John. We joked about
that. Yeah. That'd be cool.
Have the DOS sitting inside or something.
Yeah, just like in Day of the Tentacle, where you can play the old Maniac Mansion game. So,
Yeah.
So about the freeware release, in 2007, Halloween Harry was made freeware.
Yeah.
And it was put on a website, legacy.3drealms.com. That's the address where it,
yes.
But that address seemed to have gone offline very recently.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know. I think at Apogee, I mean, I don't know what's happening at Apogee or 3D Realms.
They've rebranded now.
Yeah, so they're working on something. And I think in the turmoil, the legacy website was taken down. So I'm not sure if this is intentional and maybe it come back. And I don't know.
Yeah, I think, well, I know we own the, well, I own the rights to Halloween Harry and Amazon.
Yeah.
So it may have been the case with that. I know I've got friends who had some stuff and I think they've sold them to Apogee. I think like Balls of Steel, for example, which is Darren who did the audio drivers. So I know that's happened. So those ones, they've got full rights on Apogee now, I believe.
Yeah. But Halloween Harry's still yours.
Yes. Yes.
So maybe, I don't know if this is something you would consider, but since the legacy website for 3D Realms is down, maybe you could offer the freeware one yourself now, because currently it's nowhere available officially.
Oh.
So.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that might be a good tie-in to release that with the new one, Pete.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's always interesting when people can get these games officially. I mean, not that it really matters. You can still find it through, you know, the Wayback Machine. You can still get it.
Yeah.
But
definitely that. Well, that was part of the reason for that was, I was really lucky that post GWiz, we formed a company called Chrome Studios, which we went on and did more console games and 3D games like Tyler Tasman Tiger. But that was one of the things is when I sold out of that company, I got my intellectual property back.
I see. Yeah. And this Chrome Studios that you were involved, it got really big. I think at one point, the biggest Australian game developer. So.
Yes.
Yeah. Still to date, isn't it, John? I'm sure.
No. Well, I mean, it was the biggest. Yeah, it got to 400 odd people at one point. But yeah, I think in terms of, and particularly for Australian owned, we have big studios here now, but they're not
Australian owned though, are they?
They're multinational. So it was one of the bigger, Australian-owned companies. So it was myself, Stephen, Rob Walsh, owned that company.
That's amazing.
But yeah, it's shrunk right down now. There's like a handful of them tinkering away on port games.
I read somewhere that there were ideas about a third, I say third, actually fourth Halloween, like a follow-up to Zombie Wars. And I also read there were ideas flown around about making it a cartoon series.
Yes. So
What's up with this?
As I mentioned, we love cartoons. We love movies. So we started putting together a pitch deck and wrote some scripts and sent them off and had discussions with, not much discussion, but sending off to people. We actually had more actual interest with Film Roman for Tyler the Tasman Tiger as a cartoon show, but that didn't go anywhere. I think, you know, in Hollywood, everything gets options. So when someone says they've optioned their movie or their book, I think that's like a dime a dozen. Is that right, Pete? Would you say that's the case?
Oh, yeah. It's, yeah.
Did you actually go to Hollywood, though, to pitch Halloween Harry?
Not with Halloween Harry, no. Halloween Harry was the point we made some scripts. We sent off and was trying to get interest in licensing and also stuff. I think I published some of them online. Yeah, they're quite entertaining. Again, we've kind of gone back and mined some of that material for the new
game. Definitely. Yeah.
I'd love to see this. Yeah.
Yes. I sent some stuff through to you. But then for Ty, we did go to Hollywood and we did go to Comic-Con and we met with Film Roman. So that one was
right.
A bit further along.
That's Ty, the Tasmanian Tiger that you worked on at Chrome.
Yeah.
Was Pete involved with Ty or is that...
No, I wasn't involved with Ty, no. I did work at that point. But I did actually work for Chrome a couple of times. Yeah.
Right.
In a sort of a...
Because you always stayed in touch, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Like you said, we were best man at each other's wedding.
Yes.
No.
So,
we always did. Yeah. It's just, but how far did it get with the Film Roman thing? Did
it got to the point where we had writers hired, some writers who wrote for the Ninja Turtles cartoon series, actually wrote some scripts, which is great. So we had a bunch of scripts made. And then it just, I guess like anything in Hollywood, it just like, you know, nothing happened. I know there's authors and writers locally who've written stuff and optioned, and that's it as far as it gets. But it was exciting, though.
Yes. I was reading about this. I thought, oh, this is great. Yeah. Even just get a feel for that industry must be quite exciting.
That's right. But look, who knows? If anyone's listening, can come, you know,
sure.
Options. Yeah. The new one.
Excellent.
Yeah.
You've always kind of, you mentioned this earlier, that you were always trying new technologies. For example, using Godot now as a game engine instead of the more mainstream Unity, perhaps.
Yes, and Blender.
And Blender, indeed. And also you've made all these watch games that are, well, I wouldn't say a smartwatch is the most mainstream platform for games. So,
no.
I mean, it seems you're always interested in doing the new thing that might be, you know,
yeah,
not what everyone is doing. Not following everyone's lead, but rather setting the example. So
that's a very nice way of saying it. Yeah, I think, I don't know. I know what Sheryl Pete's perspective of it is, but I do say to Pete, let's do this and then we go off and make something crazy. Yeah, I am attracted to new things. And Godot, yeah. I mean, it's not new, but Godot is just such a, yeah, I mean, I think we're both big open source advocates, Pete and I.
We are now. It's funny, whenever John has an idea for a game, whatever else, we have a little sort of unit of measure as far as getting it, my involvement, and that is, well, if it makes enough to buy me a cup of coffee, John. And that's the unit of measure. So I've had a few coffees.
But there's also just a joy in creation, right? There's also just,
I don't think you'd do this if it was strictly all about, surely as far as you can.
There's much easier ways to make money than making games by yourself. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I think the thing that, as I said, I'm not a huge game person myself, but what's drawn me into this over the, particularly working on Harry, is I get the same sense of satisfaction and creative outlet that I get in any other sort of media that I've worked in. And in fact, more so because it's just John and I.
Mm.
And so we're creating this whole world.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, to be honest, we've always been doing something, you know, we're always doing our job and then doing something else. That's never going to change, I don't think. Well, it hasn't. I mean, here we are now. We're still doing it.
I think the passion probably shows in the game. You know, some games you can just feel that the developers were excited about this. I think the players will feel this probably.
I hope so.
Hopefully, anyway.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the new Halloween Harry game started as a very simple, very basic, probably with the idea to make it quickly.
That's exactly right. Because that was looking at Amazon Queen going, it's been 5 years. And as I said, having known friends, you know, Francisco Gonzalez has done an amazing job with Rosewater, but I think he spent close to 5 years in that. And, you know, he's really working hard on that. And I know we probably couldn't put the amount of effort he put into that. So, yeah, 5 years for us was probably an underestimation. So the idea was, let's go back, kind of ironically, because it's what happened in the 90s with Halloween Harry and Amazon Queen. Let's go back and do Harry. And do a simpler version that was very much a Vampire Survivors type idea.
Yeah.
That was the concept. And as we began building it, it was like, first didn't feel right, didn't feel true to Harry. And then as we started to move back into what Harry had, and as I said, I was a bit against the idea of, well, very against the idea of the jetpack, because that just opened up the can of worms with verticality and how we're going to represent that in 3D. Then we experimented with it. One of the things we're good, and we talked about this, Pete and I, is I like the improv approach to design and development, which is your yes and. So Pete might say, what if we do this? Like, oh, yes, we'll do that and this. So we'll always try it out, even if it's, and I'll say, I don't know if that's going to, I can't answer if it's going to work or not. I think it's best to try it because so many times, I mean, I'm very lucky. I know some people have made some amazing games. Matt Hall, a friend of mine, made Crossy Road.
Yeah.
And another friend made a game called Ski Safari, Brendan. And I remember seeing both early versions of those games and I was like, oh yeah, Crossy Road's okay. It'll probably do okay. And likewise with Brendan, I said, Brendan, your game Ski Safari plays itself. You should put some more challenge in it.
Mm-hmm.
100% wrong with both of those cases and then totally well. So I know that what I think is right is probably not right. So it's always good to test it. Put in the game.
Good to try it.
Yeah, with getting that feedback like we did with the festivals and things and whatever else is really good. And as I think I mentioned, my sons, as I said, can play Death Stranding one day and then the most basic of 2D games the next.
there's definitely more of an interest in these smaller endeavors now, I feel. The indie games are definitely on people's radar, so yeah.
Yeah. And there's no such thing as we're keen on the feedback. We had a massive list after that festival of things, yeah. And oddly enough, Jetpack came up. And that's something that we're keen to do. We want to make sure that this thing, you know, we want it to make sure people enjoy it, you know. Mm.
It sounds like you're working on it together mostly. Is anyone else playtesting this or seeing versions, or do you show it to anyone?
Beyond the festivals and the there's a thing called Squiggly River, which I haven't been to for a while, but it's a really great little indie gathering in the State Library in Brisbane here, run by Brendan Keogh. And I liken it to, I've said to Pete that this is where the next big indie hits will come from, is this really creative group of people who aren't commercially minded, yet the games they make are so unique that, you know, it's, I don't know if you've ever heard of a game called Shower with Your Dad Simulator.
Sorry?
You ever heard of that? It's a Steam game. It's called Shower with Your Dad Simulator. It's the most.
I don't think we move in the same circles, John.
This sounds really bad. What it was? It was a meme game, right, that came out back, and you'd gift it to your friends back in the early days of Steam.
I see.
And he made this really. It's crude South Park graphics, and the idea is it's very innocent. It's so you play a character, and you got to match that. Like there's a tall person, a short person, and you got to, it's all pixelated, so it's all blurred out. You got to move the character to the right shower stall. It's like it sounds terrible. Anyway, I thought that was an American game, and I met the person who made it, and they're quite normal. But that was the reason they made it. It was this meme game, and it back in 2016 when it came out, it was a smash hit, and made them a fortune. Anyway.
Yeah,
but this is the sort of weird eclectic people that are making these.
Yeah, I mean. I think it's funny with us and Harry, because Harry, technically, you'd probably look at it and think, well, it's not really in that realm of independent game. But having said that, though, I think that's where, I mean, we've enjoyed, I think, being surrounded by independent game makers because, they're creative, they're really smart, and really, it's just nice to be involved in a place where the main thing is the thing itself.
Not corporate decisions, Well, it's honestly the reason why, I mean, I can only speak for myself, but to me, those indie games that are being made are very similar in spirit to the old MS-DOS games and the old, you know, it's all small teams making whatever they like, not too much, you know, peer testing or whatever you call it. Like, it's not designed by committee, none of that. There's an overlap between those worlds.
Yeah, it's just pure, you know, people making games of love and just, I think there's also there's lack of commercial having to do a few for commercial reasons, but oftentimes you get these really amazing ideas that come out of that.
Yeah, and ironically, this gives it potential to do well commercially because people can see the passion and...
Yeah.
So...
Well, just... And for that same group is like Unpacking came out of that group of people. Mm-hmm. Unpacking was an indie just a few years ago where you unpack a house and unpack boxes. That's done locally in Brisbane. So there's all these really kind of, and that's probably a game I wouldn't have picked being a massive hit. It was. I saw it. Well, that's nice.
Yeah, exactly. You can't predict these things. Yeah. So,
no, it's very hard to predict, I think. And I think if you try and think about that, I think you just send yourself mad. I think the bottom line is just making sure that what we do is something that's enjoyable to play. It's funny actually, I think I had to sort of almost nudge John a bit in this direction because obviously John had created the game and that it's his thing, you know. But I keep talking about honoring the original game with our new thing. I want people who have played the original to look at this thing and go, oh, that's kind of nice. Yeah. I like they've done that, you know. Oh, I do remember that. Yeah. It's different because it's 3D and hopefully it's bigger, better. But I like that. And I'm always saying that. I said, you know, I like trying to lay those little things into this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway. Yeah, hopefully we don't go too Phantom Menace with it. That's my Where's my childhood? No. Yeah. Whereas we really do feel that this is this does feel, you know, hopefully when you play it you go, this is Halloween Harry, but it's modernized.
it still has the jetpack.
Does jetpack has a flamethrower as well?
Do you remember how you originally came up with the? I mean, it's sort of a unique.
It is.
Not a lot of platformers have a jetpack. It's a very weird mechanic.
I'm trying to think because I found the original prototypes in the Amiga because that's where the original one was made, was in the Amiga in AMOS, and it had a jump in it. The jump was terrible, but it was like before I knew how to do physics jumps, it was like this straight up there. And I'm wondering whether that was either, but it could have been Robert. He might have been put that jetpack in, but it might have been a get around that we can't do the jump. I'm not 100% sure.
Can't figure out the jump. Make a jetpack.
Yeah, that's right. Now we can get out. Yeah,
that's interesting. Because I do think it was the jetpack that got Apogee interested. At least, if you download the freeware version, it comes with a little readme.txt, which has a little background on how the game was made, and it has a little blurb from Scott Miller who says, "Yeah, it's because of the jetpack, because it's the unique."
Oh,
so awesome. That's why they were keen to publish it, I think.
Mm, yeah, I'll have to. Yeah, it's funny because Scott did he did a little favorite on the post that he recently. I need to ask him some more details. What was that?
Since we've implemented it into the game now, it's certainly opened up a whole lot of things. And so it's actually...
makes it all very different.
They're a lot more fun. It just blew it out of the water a bit as far as what we can do now. And there's a level that we're approaching or sub-level we're approaching soon. And there's a lot of verticality in it. So that's just so far away from what we intended initially.
And the new game will have unlimited fuel, I hope.
Well, actually, no. It's unlimited. No, but because the big problem we had was if you could just fly anywhere, you could just fly everywhere and there's no game. So we does have, it's a fuel gauge which runs down, but it regenerates. So like
health. You don't have to go and purchase.
No vending machines.
So it's like a long jump. You can jetpack over distances, but you can't, because it wasn't fun.
We've got an added thing in this one though. I don't know, do we talk about that?
What is it? Yeah, what's the added thing?
Well, the drone, the our.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's the new thing, the drone.
Okay, so Halloween Harry has a drone now.
Yeah, so... Yeah. This is the reason, what we thought of was, if you've ever seen Mad Max, the movie, the Mad Max road where he has a cattle dog, and it was like, but wouldn't that be cool to have that sort of...
Well, we worked on a story ages ago, it was sort of in that sort of ballpark, a comic book story that we wanted to do, and we may end up, maybe, depending on how long we live, doing it as a game, but we had a character called Johnny Mechanic, and he had a little dog in that. We were originally going to do it as a comic book story, but the anthology series we were going to create it in, there was already a character in there that had a dog. So they said, you can't do that. We've done that. so we've sort of shelved it. But anyway, it's sort of come back a bit as this drone for Harry.
Mm.
It sort of follows him around and talks to him in its own sort of language.
Nice R2D2 type talk.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting to have a little companion like that. And is Diane still in there?
Yes. Yes.
Right. So it's an ever expanding path.
Yeah. What's great is because then there's this whole added thing with weaponry and stuff like that you can have with the drone now, which you couldn't really do a lot of with Harry. So now we've got so many more different options.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, excited for this. I mean, we'll post this and put up some links so people can dig through the materials and wish listed on Steam, all that stuff.
Yes, that'd be lovely.
But also have a look at all your previous endeavors. So if you could dig up some of those film clips you mentioned, like the ads and everything.
Yes, well, I found them today. Yeah, I'll share them.
That would be amazing. And if we could share that with people, I mean, people are into this for sure. So that would be very fun.
Yes. It's funny to see. So we're so young back then. It's quite crazy to see it how it was. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
I have to say, like these last few years working on the Watch games, and then initially Amazon Queen Return, which look, I still would love to do that one day. Yeah. Return of the Amazon Queen. It we came up with some pretty cool ideas. And
yeah.
Oh.
We did talk. I said to Pete because it was 2D, and I think with 3D rendered 2D, we're thinking, what if we use the Harry engine? Because now we've got the verticality and stuff.
Yeah.
Sort of more like a Tomb Raider slant with a real 3D, and that would be so much fun.
Yeah. Because we've discovered just, once again with 3D, just how much
is available to you, and you can do that. But really, not a lot of, well, there's effort, but it's not, you know what I mean? It's you get a lot of bang for buck.
Well, you create the assets, and then you can make them do things.
That's right.
Relatively straightforward.
Yeah.
Change the camera. It's all, you know, a lot more effort to do when drawing.
Yeah.
I also love that you're still thinking about, you know, Flight of the Amazon Queen as well.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that if this does well, there will be a Flight of the Amazon Queen game?
I think so. Because I, like I said, we both got other things we do outside of the games, and it's just the time. But the dream would be, you know, 100% back focus. It'd be great. We get that 5 year down to less. But again, if we switch to 3D, I think we can do a lot. We can definitely do it faster, I think. Not a lot faster, but
sure, John.
Yeah. My issue with point and click games is that even though they are beloved and I love them, if you look at the sales figures, they're not the biggest selling games. It's very niche.
It's a very specific audience. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. I think the return on investment, if you're purely as a business investment, is you put a lot of effort in and you don't get a huge amount back. And I think that's the hardest thing.
Mm.
But I think that's why I think if we took the spirit of the game and did it in 3D, I think there'd be it might broaden the appeal.
Yeah.
But then people might not like it because they want a static 2D backdrops.
Whatever. There's always, I don't know. I mean, I have no idea. I just know I think the point-and-click audience is maybe different people than the people who are into the more console-like third-person games. So
yeah,
I'm not sure how much overlap, but I mean, I'm not, I don't make games. I don't know. I'll let you decide.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
I guess with the advent of like this, you can have whole, you know, you can silo yourself, can't you? Really, I mean, that's what
absolutely. Yeah. Kind of,
Well, with the idea of talking about a game from 40, 30 years ago, or however long, that's pretty amazing. Yeah, so it's pretty cool. We can do this. So, and I think it's just going to get bigger. Now people can find these games. Mm-hmm. Well, except they can't find Harry anymore. I've got to fix that.
Well, if you could look into that, that would be amazing. But I mean, again, maybe Apogee will bring the legacy side back. I don't know. I don't know what they're doing. Maybe they have not even realized.
I will email Scott.
Yeah, get real cross.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, I mean, thanks a lot. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us. Very excited. So best of luck with all your endeavors. And I hope we get a lot of games out of it. So that's, you know, that's beneficial to everyone.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Wonderful. Well, it's lovely to meet you.
Well, lovely to talk to you. And thanks again for talking to me.
Thanks, man.
Well, so thanks and see you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.